Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm excited to tell you about the story behind Blood Feud, which is the true story. It's kind of like a thriller of two good buddies who were on a road trip gone bad. They were trying to blow the whistle on the first biotech blockbuster. It was made right down the road at Amgen. I don't know if many of you are familiar with Amgen, but it's kind of a homegrown tale, if you will. And it looks at the two sort of companies, the behind-the-scenes look at Johnson & Johnson, which may be a familiar name, and Amgen. And the two guys were quite an odd couple. Mark Duxbury was a blonde-haired guy from the Pacific Northwest, blue-eyed salesman, and he worked in the rainy realm of Olympia, Washington. He was thin, in fact, so pale that some people thought he was anemic, or at least albino, actually. Of course, you had to be in Washington State to understand that that's mostly what a lot of people looked like, especially even during the spring. But he was a bit of a rebel, too, because he played wonderful jazz saxophone. He loved Charlie Parker and played with some amazing talent like Tony Bennett and other people when he was younger. He almost became a musician, but instead was really attracted to medicine and science. His good buddy was Dean McClellan. He was a dark-haired, brown-eyed man who lived down in Tucson, where he spent weekends building sheds and killing rattlesnakes. He was jug-eared and had a handlebar mustache and really kind of cut a dashing figure. And he loved the Wild West. He often wore cowboy boots and a big wide-brim hat on his sales calls throughout the New Mexican desert and Arizona. And these two men met on their first day at Johnson & Johnson, where they were thrilled to be working for one of the most admired companies in the world. Maybe some of you grew up with baby powder, or No More Tears shampoo, or even maybe you've had a Band-Aid or two in your life. But this was a highly admired company, so much so that the Harvard Business School, and I'll bet several professors here, have taught future leaders like you about Johnson & Johnson and how they became the gold standard for corporate accountability. Back in the 80s, there was a Tylenol scare, where somebody, a mysterious madman they called him, had broken into bottles of Tylenol and put poison and actually killed six people. It became a huge, huge mass hysteria throughout the country. And no one bought Tylenol, but Johnson & Johnson stepped up to the podium, so to speak, and held many press conferences. And they came clean and said, look, we're doing everything we can, you know, to investigate this horrible crime. They withdrew 30 million bottles of Tylenol from the shelves. They suffered millions of dollars in losses. And then they also invented those real annoying tamper-free pill bottles, you know, that we can't get into late at night. So we can thank them for that. But because of that, they had so much goodwill that people went out of their way to go back and buy Tylenol once it was clear and, you know, the mystery was solved. So what was the drug that they were involved in now? It's called Procrit was the brand name, and it's actually known as EPO. And if some of you guys and gals are bicyclists or skiers, you may remember this drug from being something that a lot of athletes, pro athletes, got on the black market. And they would inject themselves with it in alleyways. They found it a lot in Europe. And what this drug does is it multiplies your red blood cells so much that you get a real oxygenated rush, and you can really climb on bicycles those high alpine hills, or you can run faster. And it was odd because a lot of athletes in the 80s from Amsterdam or France were suddenly falling dead at 21 or 22. And people thought it was because this EPO had stimulated their red blood cells so much, it turned their blood into sludge and made it really difficult for the heart to pump the blood through the body. And these guys would fall dead at the side of the road at 22 years old. Amgen and J&J, however, thought, oh, you know, these people are misusing the drug. They are, you know, they're getting it on the black market. We can't vouch for its safety, and we don't know how much they're taking. Our drug is safe. So there was already a red flag, a little warning signal. But it was a huge, wonderful thing for Amgen. Here was a tiny company that had finally discovered a gene on a single strand of DNA. They had figured out of some 1.5 million fragments of human genomes, this one EPO recipe, if you will. It was, and that's kind of like finding a sentence buried in the massive 20-volume Oxford English Dictionary. It took scientists at Amgen about 6 years to find it. So this was a huge thing, and the news went from, you know, pinged up to Seattle, Washington, where there were biotech firms. It went out to New Jersey, where Johnson & Johnson heard about it. People down in Boston and Washington, D.C., started descending on Amgen to try and get this gold mine of a drug, because what it could do was help anemics, and a lot of us here in this room, I know, have been anemic at one time or another. It could help people on dialysis machines, people whose kidneys didn't work. It could, you know, rejuvenate their red blood cells. It could help chemotherapy patients who weren't strong enough to take the toxic treatments and poisons that they have to undergo in order to radiate the cancer in their body. It had so many different uses that it was clearly a multi-billion dollar drug. But Amgen was so tiny, they had no idea how to push this drug through the regulatory environment. So they linked up with J&J, which was known for its marketing muscle and had great connections in Washington, D.C. And the two were supposed to be arm in arm walking down the marriage aisle. Well, that was mistake number two. You have, first of all, a pretty impossible agreement, which is that Amgen was only supposed to sell to the dialysis market. And J&J was supposed to stay out of the dialysis units and only sell to the cancer people. But there were all kinds of loopholes, and Amgen had gotten to the market first. And it began to go into cancer areas, and it began to take some of J&J's business. And J&J and Mark Duxbury and Dean McClellan got real upset. And so they went after Amgen's business, and pretty soon the whole bloody mess winds up in court. But meanwhile, Mark and Dean don't know about this. So they're trying to, well, I should back up a little bit. One of the sort of dirty secrets about some of America's healthcare system is that a lot of it is paid, I'd say about 60% of it, is paid for by either Medicare, Medicaid, or other public health programs. The police department here in Santa Barbara, they get public health care, and their drugs are paid for by public programs. And what the drug companies do is when they report the prices that Medicare and Medicaid are going to reimburse the hospitals and the doctors for, they write their own number. So, for example, if Procrit cost actually only $70, they would tell the government that, no, really, the average wholesale price is $100. And that way, it becomes a selling point. The doctors, the hospitals, the clinics, they get to pocket a little bit of the profit. And they argue that nurses, the doctors need to pay the nurses, the hospitals need to pay the clerks, and that this extra 5 or 10% is actually sort of underwriting the entire office, the doctor's office. But what Dean and Mark learned is that they were selling at 30% discount from the average wholesale price, and sometimes 40%. So they were enriching their clients tremendously. And of course, which doctor wouldn't want to earn 30 or 40% on this brand new biotech drug? So both Amgen and J&J reps are fighting each other, lowering the discount rates, even going so far as to give $40,000 checks for a new computer system. Or maybe, doctor, you'd like to join me in Hawaii and our company. We're going to have a big resort trip. You and your wife can come on over. Drinks on the house. And this is sort of the way that not just J&J and Amgen, but pretty much every pharmaceutical company does business, or at least did during the mid-90s when this story was unfolding. So some people might call it bribes, kickbacks. And we'll get into a little bit more of that. But I want to read to you, there's a lot of great incentives for these salesmen to do it. In other words, to sort of game the system. One reason was because everyone else did it, you know, and they went along with it. And this is an ethical question that maybe some of you can sort of ponder. Mark even thought that it was part of, you know, the way you do business. You go ahead and you give the guy a little money, and he pretty soon becomes your biggest client. But these men and women who are on the road every week, you know, traveling around, they were far from their families, they had no friends. They would stay in hotel rooms with thin blankets and really bad coffee. And they would have to go out and knock on doctors' doors or get into nurses' offices. And a lot of times they were turned away just because, oh, we don't want to do business with you guys. We're good friends with J&J. So by the time Mark, you know, he struggles and he really gets up there, he goes throughout the Northwest. He drives for miles and miles. He's away from his family, his wife and his baby girl, for months at a time. And he finally makes his sales goal. He hits $100,000 in the first few months of his employment there. And after a while, he becomes a very well-known, you know, one of the best-known salesmen there. And pretty soon, he's selling $1 million, $2 million. And so how he gets rewarded big time. There's a sort of corporate culture that goes along with this, where the pharmaceutical companies, or at least J&J, knew that these men were very lonely on the road, but they're all very affable and sort of, you know, party guys. So once a quarter, they would all get together at a company-sponsored resort or party, and they would be rewarded. During the day, they would have study sessions or breakout sessions, and at night, there'd be tons and tons of fun. Mark got to the point where he actually became the highest-selling salesman in this young company. And I just want to read a little bit from the book so that you get an idea. He and his wife were sent. Now, remember, he's up in the Northwest where it's raining, cats and dogs, and he's offered a chance to go to Palm Springs for about 4 or 5 days, where they're driven around in limos, and they get to have all these wonderful dinners. And then there's the night of the big banquet, where Mark will be rewarded with a champion gold ring. It's a real knuckle breaker, too. I should have brought it for you. So here we are at twilight, when Duxbury, dressed in a tailored suit, and McClellan, wearing a tuxedo and bow tie, waited nervously outdoors on a red carpet with their women, who were dressed to the nines. A slight breeze moved the palm fronds into ever-shifting runes. The sky burned a deeper shade of orange. A lizard scurried over a boulder. Then they heard the escorts before they saw them, kilted men playing an ancient warrior tune on drums and bagpipes. Some biosphere honorees, that was the name of the award, were already trailing the musicians, and as soon as the ensemble passed by, the two couples fell in line too. Now, an outsider might snicker at the sight of adults dressed in dark suits and long gowns, following Pied Pipers in the desert sun, marching to the Celebrity D ballroom. But they'd be missing the point. This was a carefully orchestrated ritual designed to strike an emotional chord in this core of big game hunters. And whether it was the Highland drone, the tartan plaid, or the pomp and pageantry, the effect on at least two of these men was profound. So they're sitting at a banquet, you know, like they're in Valhalla, you know, with all the other top dog salesmen, and they're being honored by their presidents and their vice presidents. And they go out that night under a full moon in the desert, and they liberate some golf carts that they found, and they zoom over them on the golf course, and they're drinking scotch and toasting one another. And, you know, that's about as good as it ever got for Mark Duxbury. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to the reps, there are the companies, like most drug companies, you probably know this, they are asked to test their drug in post-marketing studies. That means after they're approved. And Johnson & Johnson and Amgen were told to test their drug in a larger patient population for safety. They were told 1993, 1994, 1995, 1996, and they never did. Now, that was a problem because there were still bicyclists who were dropping dead in Europe from, you know, injecting themselves on the side of the road. But there were also sort of disturbing independent studies that showed that The drug would thicken the blood so much that a lot of dialysis patients were having heart attacks and strokes, and some of them were suffering aneurysms. And here was a really scary part, is that it seemed, it wasn't proven, but it seemed as though the drug also could multiply tumor cells. Now you have to think about that for a minute, because you had chemotherapy, people who had cancer, and they had a hope of beating cancer. And they were making themselves strong enough, you know, fighting anemia by taking this drug. And then perhaps they were also multiplying their tumor cells, and they were meeting their death a little bit quicker than they might have been otherwise. Nobody knew, because the studies would not be performed. And that's a whole conundrum that we should probably explore later. But neither Mark nor Duxbury, you know, Dean knew about this, and they continued to sell more and more drug. Meanwhile, Amgen was fighting J&J in the courtroom, and like a lot of corporations, they decided to take it out of public court and go into the secret, almost like kangaroo court that arbitration has been called. And the first person they subpoenaed was Mark Duxbury. Now here's a man who, although he's a rebel, he had a very strong moral code. And by that I mean that he knew there were some things he would not do. You know, he would not drink tequila the night before a final, for example. He also could not look at something knowing it was wrong and go to sleep that night. He was the sort of guy that had to point out when somebody was doing something wrong, and this got him in trouble, and it would for this particular story. When he was called in to testify by Amgen against J&J, he was asked, did you go into dialysis places? Did you try and steal our clients? And he said, yeah, I was told to. Not only that, he kept going on, he was giving doctors free drug, knowing that they were probably going to bill the insurance companies at that high price I told you about. And at one point he said, you know, to his boss, wait a minute, we're teaching these guys, encouraging them to commit Medicare fraud. And the boss said, you know, don't worry about it. That's not your business. All you're doing is you're giving them the free drug. What they do after that is their problem. And Mark kind of swallowed that, but he went ahead and, you know, handed out the vials of EPO like it was candy. He also told about the payments. You know, he told Amgen about the payments that Johnson & Johnson told him to give doctors. He told about the wonderful resort parties. And a good thing this was in arbitration behind closed doors, because had there been a reporter around, you know, looking at public records, it would have been a huge story in the mid-90s. And once Mark, I don't think he realized the consequences of speaking the truth or of speaking out. And he just thought, he loved Johnson & Johnson so much. He admired this company so much. Of course they would fix something if they thought it was wrong. So he told his boss, he told his boss's bosses what he was seeing. He was advising them on how they could fix things. And pretty soon, Mark begins to be shunned. He's sort of one of the alpha males who's pushed out of the herd. His bosses don't give him the great assignments or the good clients. They start to take away market share but increase his quarterly goals. And he gets so tense. He doesn't want to lose his home. He doesn't want to lose his wife. He doesn't want to lose his child. But all those three things happen to him over the next few years. In fact, it's so bad that he has a nervous breakdown. And he takes medical leave. And during that time, doctors under Johnson & Johnson's plan begin to give him a cocktail of drugs to sort of calm his shaking hands, to help him sleep at night. But they only make things worse. He starts hallucinating. He hears voices. He hears the telephone ringing. He hears his boss berating him. They're giving him Xanax, Paxil, Prozac, you know, sometimes all together. And this actually makes his situation far worse. He realizes that he could continue going down this road and possibly, you know, wind up dead, either through suicide or a, quote, natural death, and he gets off all the drugs all on his own. And I don't know how, but he was one of these people that just had a real strong constitution, but also a deep spirit. And he was able to bring himself back up, go back to work, and he became a real tiger. He went after J&J and all of his bosses even more voraciously than he did before. Meanwhile, his good buddy Dean was in the desert, selling to New Mexican on the Indian reservations, selling to all the great, huge Arizona cancer clinics, flying up to Las Vegas. And I'd like to read to you, or set up this scene first a little bit. What's happening now by the time Mark goes back is that Johnson & Johnson is promoting high doses, if you will, overdoses of a drug. Now, the drug was approved by the FDA at a low or reasonable dose, but J&J went up 33% higher. They were gunning the needle in people. And this was a nationwide promotion. And it's called off-label promotion. And even though doctors can prescribe a drug at a higher level if they really think it'll help the patient, it's against the law for companies, pharmaceutical companies, to promote it as a marketing, a campaign, sales campaign. But this is what all of the reps, including Mark when he came back, were told to do, or else you'd lose your job. Now, a lot of times, Medicare or the insurance companies wouldn't pay for the high doses. You know, these were pretty expensive drugs. They were about $1,200, $1,500 a month. And a lot of people couldn't pay for them on their own, which is why it was a blessing they had public insurance. But then the doctors who bought these drugs wholesale, they were not being reimbursed. They were buying $1 million a year and getting stuck with the bill. And Dean found this out the hard way, and I'd like to read to you. You know, you think salesmen have an easy job? Check out what he had to go through here. Her eyes spitting flames, her nostrils flaring, an office assistant for a client slammed McClellan into the wall of the doctor's office, causing the hanging pictures to rattle. The henna-haired woman must have been 6 inches shorter than McClellan, but at 180 pounds, she had the neck and shoulders to throw him to the ground. She was screaming, poking her stubby finger into his chest repeatedly as horrified patients looked down. "Is this how you treat your big clients, hotshot?" she yelled. Several patients in the doctor's waiting room gasped loudly, and a few stood up and slowly backed away from the scene. But the woman seemed oblivious to their fears, and she hurled her words at her target even harder. "If this is how you treat us, I'll take my business to Amgen." McClellan winced. "Calm down a minute, will you? What are you talking about? We are not getting our money like you said we would," she barked, jabbing her forked finger at his bony sternum. "And," she added, her face inches from his, "we're not buying any more damn Procrit until we get reimbursed for what we've already bought." Their eyes locked. He held his breath. "Okay, let's talk." She holstered her finger. So he had to calm down, and he had to go back into the office. And with a woman standing over him, breathing fire on his neck, he went through all of her entries in the accounting books. Now, that's not something that an ethical salesman would do, but he did, and he tried to get her paid in the following way. He eventually found out that she was making big-time mistakes in her accounting. So he and his company flew in someone called a code mistress. And this woman specialized in teaching McClellan's clients how to put the right code on the Medicare forms, which are called HICFA, or they used to be HICFA 1500, and how to falsify, if you will, the illegal doses so that the company or the doctor's office would get paid. Sometimes that didn't work, however. So an ortho or Johnson & Johnson executive way back in New Jersey started writing letters on behalf of the clients. They were ghostwriting letters to Medicare, to Medicaid, saying, you know, this is the standard of care in the cancer community. We think you really should reimburse us. And pretty soon, there were billions, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars being reimbursed for these illegal doses, doses that were harming people, or at least that's what Duxbury thought. While Duxbury's blowing the whistle and trying to alert his bosses, and he eventually gets fired, as you can probably guess, McClellan is rising even higher and higher. And he begins to even back away from his buddy a little bit, but they never quite break. And it's this wonderful camaraderie that sort of unfolds in the book that you really begin to understand how one man could have a totally different moral compass, you know, and not be able to, at all to do anything wrong, while his best friend would be able to go down a road with his eyes closed and not, you know, kind of like, nah, not listen to his friend at all. And that's what McClellan did. And he did that because he was selling $100 million, $200 million. He was earning a lot of money flying around to all these different places. He even hung out with Cindy Crawford, who was hired to entertain some reps one night, you know, totally legitimately, don't get me wrong here. But, you know, one night at a resort, the Eagles would play for all these high-rolling pharmaceutical salesmen. Sheryl Crow, you know, who ironically was going out with Lance Armstrong, who, rumor has it, you know, was able to get the Tour de France because of EPO. So it's just, you know, all these little sort of roads that we travel in this book. And he continues to sell until one night he realizes that what Mark has been telling him has been true all this time. He looks at a clinical study that he helped to oversee, and he finds that 40% of the people in this study sort of dropped out. They either weren't accounted for, they had died, or something else happened. And he wondered, I mean, it was a huge number. That's almost like half of the patients. And also, he's having a tough time because his bosses know that Dean is cooperating with Mark, his good friend. Now, the thing about Dean is that he was a pack rat. He had 15,000 documents. He saved every single sales document he had, every single sale, you know, sales brochure, all the pictures he had taken of him with the pretty president, Carol Webb. He had, you know, it was a journalist's dream, but probably a defense attorney's nightmare. And he and his buddy one night, out in the desert, they went through all of the cache, you know, all these wonderful documents, and they loaded them into a U-Haul truck. And at night, they drove, you know, a few hours from Tucson to Phoenix. And they stood in a copy room, and they had to hire, actually, a whole crew of copy people who would stand over Xerox machines all night as the engines whirred and the lights were flashing. And they made copies of this just in time, because the next morning, as they were unloading it, the J&J managers for Dean were on their way to fire him. And they were going to take away all those documents. So it was like, whew, they thought, all the damning evidence is gone. But no, Mark was flying all of that evidence in an airplane going up to Seattle, where he had an attorney who was going to file a whistleblowing case. Now, I don't know if there's any law students here or people interested in law, but QI-TAM or whistleblowing cases are much different than normal civil actions. And the reason they're different is because several reasons. One is that you file a whistleblowing case in order to get back taxpayer money, whether it's defense contractors who are selling $400 hammers or pharmaceutical companies who are selling $2,000 pills. QI-TAM means, it's sort of Latin for the king. You're filing this on behalf of everybody and for the country, for the king. But that means that these whistleblowers have to go for years and years and years without any money. They have to find an attorney who's willing to fight for them without getting paid at all. And they're up against huge, enormous, you know, healthcare conglomerates that pay attorneys about $900 an hour, you know, to continue to thwart their suit. And so Duxbury went through several attorneys before he had an idea. He was sitting one morning in Seattle eating his breakfast, drinking his coffee, when he opens the paper and sees Jan Schlickman. Now, how many of you remember the name or know the name Jan Schlickman? Did you ever see the movie A Civil Action, where John Travolta played Jan Schlickman? A Civil Action is a wonderful book that was turned into an Oscar-nominated film. And it starred John Travolta as Jan Schlickman. And Jan had already gone up against two huge corporations who had polluted waters in a small town in Massachusetts, and the water had actually killed a few children, you know, little 7 and 8 year olds. And during that horrific fight with Jan, a sole practitioner, up against these two giant companies, he had gone bankrupt, both financially and eventually emotionally. He couldn't take it. It broke him. He left the country. He went, you know, got a hobo stick and walked around the islands of Hawaii. But he came back, mostly because he fell in love with a woman here in Boston in the country. And they got married, and he swore never ever to practice law again. Instead, he was trying to mediate, get, you know, different companies to sit down and mediate with people. Let's find common ground. Let's find common interest. So when Mark contacted Schlickman, you know, this gangly guy out in Boston, the old fire in Jan's belly started to rise again. He was a crusader, and he had to take on this case. Even though he'd never, ever, ever gone up against, never tried a whistleblowing case, and was certain to probably fail if he knew what he was in for. So just like Mark and his pale white skin, and Dean with his cowboy hat, Jan Schlickman is kind of a character too. And I'd like to read you the following passage just so you get a flavor. A snowy-haired tall man lay supine on the floor of a staid conference room, like a big bird in pain. "Oh, my God, I'm dying," he proclaimed, adding a profanity. He moved one knee to his shoulder, knocking one of the expensive leather chairs into the polished table. Duxbury, McClellan, and the others in the room politely turned away, giving the moaning exerciser a little privacy. Now, each law firm's conference room is just slightly different from the next, and up here, 40-plus stories high, Duxbury could admire the limestone walkways, Art Deco street lamps, and jewel-like dome of a former speakeasy once run by Al Capone. McClellan looked down at the murky Chicago River. A lawyer noticed his gaze and said, "Oh, on St. Patrick's Day, we throw dye in the river to make it look green." McClellan scratched his head. "Oh, you don't need to do that. It's already green." The man on the floor writhed in pain. "Oh, my God." Now, word had rippled through the halls of the firm that the noted lawyer was planted right here in the conference room. At first, just a few associates nonchalantly walked by, their heads swiveling ever so slightly to peek through the glass-paned window at the great man. But as soon as a few passerbys spotted Schlickman rolling on the floor like a wounded heron, they disappear and return snickering, this time with a few more disbelieving friends in tow. McClellan watched as the line of rubber-necked lawyers thickened, their eyes bugging out, their Adam's apples bobbing, looking like a flock of hyperthyroid turkeys jockeying for a clear view. The man on the floor moaned, "Oh, my God." Now, all of this stuff is true, I should add. I really didn't make it up. Jan really was rolling on the floor. He had taken a commercial flight to Chicago to link up with a very wealthy law firm who tries a lot of healthcare cases. And this man agreed to fund Schlickman back in 2004, thinking that, oh, this case would only take a few years. Well, it looks as though it may be turning in. The case is still going on now in 2012, so in a way, Schlickman thinks he's been cursed with a civil action part two. Now, you may be wondering how I got involved in this story, because, you know, I'm certainly not in Chicago. I'm out here and live here in Santa Barbara and have a family and don't go, you know, jet-setting around, even though I'm lucky enough to report on some great stories for people like Vanity Fair and New York Times. And Mark had seen some of my stories. And he had tried very, very diligently to try and get this story covered by the New York Times, by the Wall Street Journal, by the LA Times, the Washington Post, you name it, he had contacted them. And nobody wanted to touch this story. When he called me, I didn't want to touch the story either. You know, I couldn't believe it. I mean, my God, J&J, the most admired company in the world, illegally promoting overdoses of the most expensive drug around. I mean, it's the number one Medicare reimbursed drug, by the way, EPO is. But Mark was very great. He was in the old tradition of American salesman, very affable, very charming. You know, here's one of his ties. You know, he's a very colorful guy. He would often even wear Tigger ties. That was his mascot. You know, and he thought, you know, nurses would run up to him and, oh, Tigger, Tigger, and pet his ties. But, and that was how he broke the ice. And, of course, we were connected only by a telephone, so these ties didn't work. But his jokes and very charming manner did. And he'd call every 3 or 4 months. And I didn't realize it at the time, but he was spoon-feeding me Pharmacology 101. He was sort of teaching me the ropes, you know, about how business is really done, about the AWP, the wholesale price, about the oncologists running their own pharmacy, about, you know, the rebates, you know, what you and I might call bribes, but are really part of the industry. And we did this for several years. And then in 2007, I was working on a project for the New York Times Magazine and, you know, had gotten paid. And I realized, oh my gosh, the FDA is holding a huge public meeting next week in Washington, D.C. They just slapped on Procrit the sternest warning you could ever put on a drug called a black box warning. And so all kinds of people, lawyers, nephrologists, oncologists, reporters, were coming to this meeting, and I, you know, shelled out a pretty penny and left my kids and husband and flew on a red eye to Washington, D.C. You know, I'm changing in the airport stalls, you know, trying to slap myself awake. And I take a bus and I walk into this amazing, dramatic scene where the FDA is admitting there's never been any safety studies in a large patient population on these drugs. We don't know why people are dying. And yes, we've heard, you know, there's indications that it actually might multiply cancer. And so what are they going to do about it? I don't know. But I ran out of that office or out of that meeting, and I realized, you know, I have a great opportunity here to tell this national story through the eyes of 2 star salesmen. And so that's how I did it. But I had to fund the story. You know, I'm an independent journalist, and I first sold 60 Minutes, actually, on the idea of following me to Washington, D.C. And I don't know if you watch 60 Minutes, but a lot of older people do, and there's a lot of pharmaceutical advertising on that station. And so I should not have been surprised, but I was, when a month into the story, 60 Minutes decided, you know what, we're not going to do that story. This happened in 2008, so it was sort of a tough economic time. So I go ahead and I sell the story to Vanity Fair. You know, very exciting because of Jan Schlickman, the John Travolta figure. You know, oh, he's coming back. He's made it back. Oh, let's see what happens. And we were certain, my editors and I, that there would be a happy ending to the story, or at least an ending. You know, that there would be some resolution of the lawsuit and that Vanity Fair would be the first to break it. Well, 2009 passed, 2010 passed, 2011 passed. And Vanity Fair decided not to go with the story. However, you know, by then I had already sold the book to Dutton, which is a great publishing house. And, you know, we were able to get the story out in this way, which is really quite wonderful. I think that's, you know, you may not see a lot of great nonfiction tales, especially thrilling tales like this, in newspapers or magazines anymore. But to me, there's a renaissance going on in nonfiction books. In fact, I have the pleasure and the privilege of announcing to you tonight that the movie rights have just been sold for this book. And yeah, it's pretty wonderful. Pretty wonderful. No, John Travolta's too old. We're talking to maybe Ryan Gosling or something. But it's a little bittersweet moment, in a way, because the great news is that, you know, this large story of a sort of very dysfunctional healthcare system hopefully will get out to a larger audience. But the one guy who I would love to still have here standing in this room today is no longer with us. Mark Duxbury, as a whistleblower, was so beaten down, you know, through both health problems and the ins and outs, the thrilling rides of the legal system, that he died about a year and a half ago. So it kind of pains me that he's not around to see his story, you know, get published and all that. But hopefully others will. And, you know, to some of us, this seems like a really kind of staid, boring story. It's about pharmaceuticals, it's about lawsuits, it's about faceless type of things. But I want to read you one last passage to give you an idea of the consequences, the real physical, intimate consequences of what happens when people, you know, executives, when doctors, when professors of Stanford University or Harvard Medical School, when people don't think of what their actions will bring about. Because all of these people were involved in this whole scheme, is all you can call it. There's a woman I met in one of the FDA meetings. She had been married. Her name is Sharon Lennox. And she was married to a man named Jim Lennox. And he had beat cancer once in 2004. He'd had part of his lung removed. And that had scared him so much that he quit smoking. But then they found cancer in another part of his body. And he had beat that too. The doctors had sent him home and told him that he had more time to live, so enjoy it. So Sharon brought all the family over one night. You know, they had cake, they had coffee, and they were talking after the kids had left, the grandkids, all the relatives. And Jim was sitting there. He had already shown significant improvement, according to one medical report. The oncologist had warned Sharon that her husband may not live the whole year, and she had accepted that fact, but not Jim. "We're going to beat this cancer again, honey," he said, his voice deep and steady. Sharon just smiled. She stood at the sink washing the dishes, her hands trawling the soapy basin for stray utensils. She retrieved a dish, sponged it off, and admired how her solitaire wedding ring still sparkled amid the iridescent bubbles. But suddenly, Jim fell silent. Sharon turned back to look at him and saw thick, dark blood oozing from his mouth. At first, she didn't understand. Jim coughed and he struggled to breathe, while Sharon waited for him to speak, but no words came out. Then Jim scooted to the edge of the couch, his eyes pleading for help. Sharon dropped the dish, reached for the telephone, and dialed 911. The emergency dispatch operator asked Sharon some questions, but by then, blood was spurting out of Jim's mouth and nose, thick rivulets dripping down his chin. Sharon calmly gave the operator her name, address, and telephone number, but then she screamed, "My husband is bleeding and he can't talk." Jim was now coughing up pieces of tumor and lung, according to a report filed later by the county police department. Apparently, some of his tumor was lodged in his throat, choking him. Jim's eyes were bulging, and he tried desperately to breathe as blood poured down his chest. He grew so agitated that Sharon prayed for him to pass out, and mercifully, he did. Sharon fell to the floor, too, and began administering CPR while the operator instructed her calmly from the speakerphone. Every time Sharon breathed into her husband's mouth, his warm blood gushed back into her mouth. When she pushed on Jim's chest, more blood spurted from his nose. And in no time, Sharon's face and white T-shirt were soaked in crimson, and her long ash-brown hair was matted with clumps of red matter. She continued rhythmically breathing into Jim's lungs and pushing on his chest while the operator guided her resuscitation efforts, the soothing telephone voice violently at odds with the gory scene. Well, when the paramedics finally rushed through the door, Jim was dead, and he was sort of in a halo of blood with pieces of his tumor, you know, up and out of him. The drug, he had just earlier that day gotten a huge dose, an overdose of Procrit. He had been given the dose of this drug for the 6 months prior without his knowledge, without his consent. And at that time, the FDA had already slapped the black box warning on the drug, but the patient never got the word. And that's partly because the doctor and the hospital stood to gain financially by continuing to inject their patients with as much Procrit and Epogen as they could. So there are consequences. You know, even when you're working in a great law firm, at a great, you know, most admired pharmaceutical company, when you're working in a wonderful hospital, you know, it really, of course, would pay attention to what it is you're doing and to speak up. You know, Mark tried to speak up, time and time and time again, and he paid for it with his life. And some 20 million people have been given this drug over the years, at least 20 million. And scientific studies, medical studies show now that 17% of those people have died. That's over a million people. And it could have been stopped years and years ago if someone had just listened to Mark.
I was wondering what allowed the case to go to arbitration rather than be in a public setting where like people could find out about it.
That's a great question. The companies, if two companies agree, they can go into arbitration. And what you're finding is more and more that big corporations are going into arbitration because it keeps the public documents out of, you know, the public eye. It also is a very speedy way, they say, for fights and battles to get resolved, even though this particular case went on for 10 years. Johnson & Johnson and Amgen have sued each other time and time again. One time, someone would pay $130 million. The next time, Amgen would have to pay $170 million. And you realize that, you know, it's really just about dogfights. You know, these companies and the lawyers behind the companies, there were hundreds and hundreds of lawyers. And they thought it was only about the money, or it was only about market share. And I don't think any of them, you know, realized what Jim Lennox or a few hundred thousand other people had to go through, because if they had, they would have pulled it. I'm sure Johnson & Johnson is not going to be happy if there's a movie on the big screen. You know, that will do more to their goodwill reputation than anything.
I was reading in the Wall Street Journal that the former CEO of Johnson & Johnson has just been pushed out the door. Does this case have anything to do with his sudden and unplanned departure?
Well, it's funny you would bring that up. I've been getting a lot of email, actually, and some people believe that is true. But I would also present to you that William Weldon, who actually strikes me as a man who came from blue-collar roots. You know, his mother was a seamstress for playhouses in New York, and his dad drove a truck. So you would think a guy like this would sort of have connections and think about consequences. But once he became chairman in 1998, you saw Procrit being abused, you saw Risperdal. There have been dozens and dozens of drugs that have either been part of a Department of Justice investigation, or even baby Motrin has been pulled from the market time and time again the last 2 years. So I think he was under a lot of pressure, as a lot of publicly held companies are, to post those ever higher quarterly earnings. And this is, he's now going to end his reign in with a cloud over him, although he's still chairman. And I wonder how that works. He may not be CEO, but he's still running the roost.
Have there been a lot of investigations into Medicare fraud since Johnson & Johnson was brought up?
Some people say there haven't been enough investigations. During the Bush administration, when I started reporting on this, there were 900 whistleblowing suits sort of gathering dust in the Department of Justice. And the reason I bring up the Department of Justice is because they are the big cop on the block. And Duxbury was always hoping that the DOJ, the Attorney General, would join the suit, because then Johnson & Johnson would settle. But instead, Schlickman has poked along all by himself and without the full force of the government. Now there are 1,300 whistleblowing suits gathering dust. So there's even more whistleblowers waiting for their day in court. Meanwhile, GlaxoSmithKline recently settled for $3 billion. Pfizer recently settled for $2.5 billion. But if you think about it, Medicare and Medicaid constitutes about $1 trillion a year. And of that, at least 10% is fraud. So that means $100 billion of fraud every year, mostly by pharmaceutical and healthcare companies. So if we've only had $8 billion last year in settlements, and yet there's $100 billion, I would say or argue that there's certainly not enough investigations. And that could be for a lot of reasons. I'll give you two right now. One is that there aren't enough federal dollars to fund a real vigorous and healthy Department of Justice. But here's another thing I want you to think about. Guess who the head of the Department of Justice is? His name is Eric Holder, and he used to defend Johnson & Johnson. And he's probably going to go back to the same company that defended Johnson & Johnson if Obama loses. And that's not unlike the Bush administration, where the head of the Department of Justice, the big cop on the block who was supposed to enforce our laws, he too had once worked for a defense firm that defended Johnson & Johnson, Michael Mukasey. So you have this amazing revolving door where the corporate, you know, sort of like the fox is inside the hen house. The corporate people are calling the laws, and they're using our money. They're supposed to be working for us as public servants. But they go back to wonderful corporate jobs where they're paid very well to defend the same lawbreakers that they were supposed to pursue in public office.
I'm just wondering where Procrit stands now with the FDA, and is it on the shelves?
Very good question. You know, you'd think after all of this that it would be pulled. I mean, Avandia has been pulled, Vioxx was pulled, and these drugs only harmed a few, you know, tens of thousands of people. But right now, you and I could go into a hospital and get a shot of Procrit. Last year, the FDA announced everybody should do everything they can to stay away from this drug. If you think you're going to die in 2 months, okay, go ahead and take it. But otherwise, stay off of it. Dialysis patients who most of the time are unhealthy, you know, they are much more apt to have heart attacks and strokes, but they get the drug, mostly because Amgen and Johnson & Johnson have lobbied very, very well to keep this not only on the market, but to keep you and I and taxpayers, you know, paying for it through Medicare, Medicaid, and our own insurance companies. So, I mean, that's a huge drag on all of our health plans and really should not be allowed, but it is.
Since your book came out, I believe, in late last year,
Right, fall.
Have you started to see any effect from spreading the word this way before the movie gets made?
Effect in what way?
Well, in terms of more interest on the part of the regulators, more interest in the part of state legislators who, you know, could do some pressure on themselves if they...
Well, that's a great question, too. I haven't been called to testify in any congressional hearings, but I've talked a lot on NPR and lots of radio stations. You know, Oprah Magazine picked this as one of her top 10 picks. So, and I'll have to tell you, too, that I wanted to write this book in a very thriller John Grisham sort of way, because I want my brother, who's a longshoreman, or my sister, who doesn't read anything but Bodice Busters, to actually read this book and maybe take something away from it. So, you know, it's been really wonderful to get the feedback from the sources and from the great reviews, because I figure the more people that hear about Mark Duxbury's story, the more we can all sort of work to change the system. And that was really all Mark wanted to do. He just wanted people to hear the story again and again so that somebody is held accountable for all of this.
Are doctors not educated enough by the people that they are being visited, pharmaceuticals, so that they continue to prescribe Procrit even in overdose formation? So I'm assuming I'm a physician. If I would know that I'm doing something illegal, then I am not a physician, because if you are a doctor, the first thing that we do by our oath is to not do harm.
Right, do no harm.
Exactly.
That's right. Well, I think that a lot of doctors didn't think it out. They didn't sit down and realize, wait a minute, this is off-label. I'm being paid $10,000 a year to be a consultant. I'm being taken to this resort and that resort. And it's really no different than what Pfizer or Eli Lilly or all the other companies have done. I don't think they thought about it. They're very, very busy. I do have to say, though, I met a few doctors who refused to take pharmaceutical money back in 2006. And, of course, now there's been so much heat on doctors and so much brouhaha over this whole practice that next year, thanks to what some people call Obamacare, we can all go online and put in our doctor's name and then see if he's been taking pharmaceutical money. That will become a new law in March 2013. So you find doctors suddenly saying, oh, I can't see you, Mr. Pharmaceutical Man. You know, no, I don't want any lunch today, or can't go to Hawaii, you know, I'm going to go up to Olympia. But, you know, there's been a huge controversy, and yet because we pulled back so many federal dollars, who else is going to fund research, or who's going to pay for medical schools? You know, you suddenly realize how much the pharmaceutical companies have been subsidizing public education or even private education. And so it's going to be a whole big sea change, I think, for us in the next few years to stop a lot of those corrupt practices.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.